I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Glenn?
Glenn?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, fine. Yeah, I'll speak to you later. Yeah, I love you. Okay, bye. Oh, hello everyone. Hi, yes, hi. Just finishing off a phone call with a dear friend of mine. This is Joel McIver, and the thing you're about to hear is a wonderful compilation of our best parts over the 23 episodes of Dead Rock Stars that we recorded for our first season. Amply and well put together by our dear friend Ian Callahan, our producer, very strange man, but looks nice. We hope this will be entertaining, so hang in there and we'll catch up with you soon.
You talked about faxes.
Yes.
Quick story that always makes me laugh. Mm. And I think it kind of shows the sensitive side of Lemmy and also the bastard, if you like.
Yeah.
But also funny. Mm. So anyway, I can't remember getting to this, but we're talking about poetry.
Mm.
And he starts telling me how, you know, he apart from lyrics, he writes reams of poetry.
Mm.
And at the time, I actually was having some of my poetry published. I don't know why I'm laughing.
I didn't know you wrote poetry.
I'm a great poet.
Does it rhyme?
No, fuck off.
For Christ's sake,
that's
Nick.
Not poetry.
That's not real then, is it?
No. No. Anyway.
Next time you have to read some of your poetry on this.
Yeah, I think Ian might step in. I think I could read it all day, but whether it would make the actual broadcast, that's debatable.
Well, it should.
Yeah, I can see you looking at him and him going like this. You must be fucking joking.
Yeah, that's it. Shut him up.
Anyway, so we're talking to Lemmy about poetry. He says, I really write a lot of poetry. I said, wow, I'd love to see some, because I was writing a lot myself at the time.
Mm.
Next thing, because he's in LA, he's 8 hours behind.
Yeah.
I'm in bed at about 2 a.m. one night, and I could hear...
Yeah, like the football results.
Yeah,
thing.
And it went on and on because the bastard's sending me dozens of pages.
Yeah, as
right?
He said, reams of it, right? Yeah.
And I had this old-fashioned fax machine where it wasn't like this clean A4 paper that you get now. In fact, we don't have Mac fax machines now, but
no.
It was that greasy stuff that was all on one roll.
I know it. Yeah.
Anyway, about 10 foot of this comes through, and I'm looking at it in the morning over a cup of tea, and you know, bleary and.
Mm.
And I couldn't read it all because, A, there was too much of it, and, B, it was handwritten.
Yeah.
But it was in this very kind of stylized gothic hand.
Really?
That's how I remember it.
Yeah. Are you sure you weren't under the influence of something, Mick?
Well, it's possible. No. And this thing was, I just remember it was like, this isn't a direct quote, obviously, because it's a long time ago, but it was, from the hills came the hell claw of Satan. And it was like, the blood flowed quickly over the virgin's toes.
And was he entirely serious? Or was he taking the piss?
Well, here's the thing.
Yeah.
I think he was serious.
Because
you could write a page or two of that taking the piss, but there were about 6 different poems, all long poems. And I just imagined him speeding all night.
Yeah,
he's been
up
for 5 nights, and now he's getting to the good stuff with his poetry. You know. Yeah. Hegemon came from the thundercloud.
And was it sort of embarrassing Jim Morrison-style poetry, or was there some value to it, as you recall?
Well,
as a poet yourself, Mick.
Well, speaking as a contemporary poet, and a contemporary of such poets as Lemmy.
Never mind Philip
Bruce
Larkin.
Bruce Dickinson. Enormously fantastic literary figures of our time.
Literary giants.
Giants. Yes, much better than Jim Morrison.
Yeah.
You know, Jim Morrison's is all like...
It's not setting the bar very high.
The ghost of the dead Indian came down the highway, the child with his frog in his head.
Doesn't Jim Morrison at one point say, death and my cock?
Yeah,
death of my cock.
Yeah, I think that was the best line he ever wrote, actually, speaking as an older man.
We'll have to talk about Jim Morrison, won't we, on this?
Definitely, but back to Lemmy.
Yeah.
So I'm reading this, and I'm actually very taken aback that he's taken the time to feed these endless pages into a fax machine, handwritten. So I thought, wow, do you know what? I'll send him some of mine. So I printed out three or four poems, and I faxed him back.
Yeah, yeah.
And guess what?
I don't know, what?
Fuck all happened, nothing. He was this much interested.
Maybe he was speechless because it was so good.
Maybe he just didn't give a fuck about anything I had to say or write or anything. On that first trip to Paris, Ronnie said to me out of the blue one afternoon, he said, listen, I've been working on something. I want to show you. And he held up what we now consider to be the devil horn salute with both hands.
Mick is holding them up as we speak.
I'm holding them up as we speak.
For those watching this in black and white.
Why he came up with that, he explained to me, he said, because when Ozzy used to come out on stage, he used to flash a peace sign.
Yeah.
He'd put up two hands. In fact, you can find zillions of pictures of Ozzy in Sabbath in the 70s. Bit like Nixon on the White House lawn, you know, holding up the two...
Or like Ringo Starr all the time.
Absolutely, except with two hands.
Right, got it.
Yeah, this goes to two hands.
The full Ozzy.
See, Ringo's only one hand job. you know, this is two hands.
What you're saying is this is a double hand job.
This is a double hand job of peace and love. So, Ronnie says to me, what do you think? It's kind of like, you know...
Oh, he ran it past you. Like, you
yes.
know, should I do this?
Because I'm the PR, right? Should I have pictures done like this? Should I do it on stage?
God.
And
it was that contrived.
In fairness, he could have gone like that.
He's doing rude fingers, aren't
I'm
he?
Doing... Yeah, yeah. Is that index finger?
No, middle finger.
I'm doing two middle fingers now. That's two middle fingers. He could have done that and I'd have said, yeah, whatever. But he did this and I thought, oh, that's intriguing.
If you'd said, no, that's a crap idea, Ronnie, do you think he wouldn't have done it?
He wouldn't have listened to a word I said.
Because what I was angling for was you saying yes, he would have said no, therefore establishing you, Mick, as the guy who basically authorised and pioneered the horns in metal.
Let's rewind that.
Yeah.
If I'd said to Ronnie, absolutely no way, he'd have gone, Mick, you're the expert.
Thank God for letting me know.
You're the expert. You've just saved my career. I could have looked ridiculous when I went on stage.
Well, this is the truth. Listeners, you hear about it here for the very first time. Mick Wall is the man who authorised Ronnie James Dio's pioneering use of the corna, as I believe it's known in old Italian, the dual horns, which I believe come from some sort of warding off evil thing from ancient witchcraft.
But here's the thing. He didn't mention any of that to me at the time. And being of Italian descent, I mean, it may well have been in his thinking, but at that moment, and we spent a good half an hour. He walked around the hotel room. Again, I'm doing the devil horn thing with both hands.
You do that really well, Mick.
He walked around the room showing me what he would do. And he'd obviously clearly figured it all out. And I just thought, yeah, that's genius. It's like, I'm in the tradition, but I am my own man.
Yeah.
He didn't mention anything about warding off the devil, or he certainly didn't call it the devil horn salute.
Bill warding off the devil.
Yeah. He just said, this is my version of Ozzy's peace sign.
That's amazing. And so history was established.
And so it was established.
Oh, my God. Is there not a seminal moment when Freddie met Sid Vicious, right?
There is.
Tell us what happened.
Well, the backdrop to this was a piece that NME did. Tony Stewart wrote the piece. And Tony Stewart, God bless him, you know, is not known as a laugh a minute, you know.
Not like you, Mick.
Unlike myself, who brings joy to every situation. And he interviewed Freddie in, like, the summer of 76, 77?
Yeah.
77, maybe. And the headline was, Is This Man a Prat? And, you know, it's the NME in its heyday when it was actually worth reading.
Yeah.
But he'd gone in with the hatchet fully sharpened. And he'd actually got Freddie to the point where he was talking about wanting to bring through Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah.
So I'm sure if more pop kids listened to opera, they'd open up to it.
Yeah.
Cut to a couple of months later, because they're in the studio, and Sid Vicious. Maybe we'll do one on Sid one day, but I met Sid a few times.
Yeah.
He was hilarious.
Yeah.
And he would quite often talk to you like that. I remember stepping over him once, going into the speakeasy.
I stepped over Sid Vicious.
You come down the stairs into the basement, and I stepped over Sid, and he's lying next to Nancy Sponge, and he goes, I say, old boy, could you buy me a drink? I was like, oh, fuck off, Sid.
You bastard.
So anyway, Sid bursts in, and he goes, oi, Freddie, I hear you're bringing opera to the masses. And Freddie's at the piano, you know, composing. Can imagine, like, We Are the Champions or something, you know, dun-dun-dun-dun, My Life with You, When I Look Back, you know. Sid comes in and he goes, Oi, Fred, I hear you're bringing opera to the masses. And Freddie looks up from the piano and goes, Ah, Mr. Ferocious, come sit with me at the keyboard. And Sid's like, oh, fuck off, Fred.
They were almost like polar opposites, were they not, of pop music?
Dead rock stars, because dead men can't sue.
Can I tell you about the time I met him?
You may.
1980.
Oh, Christ.
Yeah. This is about 4 months before he died.
Mm.
And I'm the PR for Black Sabbath. It was their first UK tour with Ronnie James Dio as the vocalist. Mm. And they were doing 5 nights at what was then the Hammersmith Odeon in London.
Yeah.
And Jason, I've spoken about this since. Jason was a big Sabbath fan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he loved Zeppelin, but he would have been, what, 14 then?
Yeah.
Sabbath fan. Rainbow fan. Couldn't wait to see Dio in Sabbath.
Mm.
So we got a call from their office saying tickets, passes, and I sorted it out. And I think I told you in the past, Bill Ward, you know, used to drive me nuts on that tour.
Because
every night after the show, I'd be dragged into the dressing room and Bill would be sitting there in a blubber of sweat and paranoia and drug-fueled weirdness.
Angst.
And he'd be going, fucking hell, Mick, I want you to write this down and send it out on the fucking wire. And we'd be in Sheffield and I'd be thinking, what wire? You know, there's no wire, Bill. We're not in Milwaukee, you know. Write this down. And I go, okay. And he'd go, oh, broke me drumstick in children if you grave. And I'd write all this bollocks down. And as I got to the dressing room door, Paul Clark, the tour manager, would go, have you got something for me, Mick? And I'd give him the paper and he'd roll it up into a ball and throw it in the bin. We used to call the bin the wire. Put that on the wire, you know. So anyway, I'm in the middle of this fucking Bill Ward nightmare and I'm backstage at the Hammersmith Odeon. It's like the third night of five or something. And I'm always in there on my own because no one can stand to be with him when he's like this. I'm in there on my own. Oh, so we're in the middle of Iron Man, you know. So I'm like, all right. So I'm writing it down. Suddenly the door bursts open. Bang! In comes Bonzo.
The man himself.
In comes the man.
Yeah.
And Bill's like, hello, Bonzo. I've made Bonzo. I love you, Bonzo. What did you think of this show? And Bonham goes up to the drinks table and he's looking. He's looking. He goes, where's the fucking whiskey? And we're going, let me look at the back. So Bonzo grabs this bottle, goes, takes the top off, goes, literally, gunk, gunk,
God.
Gunk,
yeah.
Gunk, 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 slams the bottle down.
Yeah.
And Bill goes, see, what did you think of Bonzo? Bonzo goes, you a fucking shite. And Bill goes, you're right, Bonzo, you're so right. I was just telling Mick we were fucking shite, wasn't I, Mick? And I'm like, no. And I'm thinking, who's this fucking madman? Because I hadn't connected the dots yet. And then I went, oh, it's John Bonham.
It's fucking John Bonham.
It's John Bonham. Yeah. Oh, isn't that time we really must be going? You know? But it was quite funny. I
mean, did you exchange a few words with him?
No, you must be joking. I melted into the background because, you know, to have someone turn around at Bill Ward's, I mean, this is 2 minutes after they've come off stage.
Yeah,
you were fucking shite. You know, it was like, not entirely how I'd have put it. You know, it was very.
It's not endearing behaviour.
Oh, I loved him for
but
it. I look
that's
back
pretty
now.
Straight, though, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the amount of times.
Straight shooting.
I would love to do that. Wouldn't you love to do that? You know, I heard you went to see Cannibal Corpse recently.
I did.
Wouldn't you love to...
Did that news come out on the wire? Well, is that how you know?
It was on the fucking wire. Wouldn't you have loved to have gone into the dressing room after smashed open the door and gone, where's the fucking whiskey? I go, hello, Joel. All right, mate. It's over there. And they're going, what do you think? Are they American?
They are.
Okay, hey, Joel. Yeah.
What do you think of the show, buddy?
What do you think of the show, buddy? I love you, buddy. We've known each other a long time, buddy. I love it when you go to our shows. You've been a long time supporter and friend and goodwill. What do you think of the show? It was fucking shite. Yeah, you know what, Joe? You're right. We were going to talk about it. Guys, I think Joel makes a valid point.
I take your point. I'm far too quiet and introverted for that to ever happen, but I take your point.
But here is a great Bowie story that Bowie told me that day after we'd finished filming.
By the way, did he remember that you had met 4 years before?
No, bless him. Not a clue, you know. And I wasn't about to remind him.
Mm.
So we finished the filming and we're leaving the hotel. I didn't realise he was standing next to me. I thought it was Gail, the producer. And I literally turned to him and I went, that was all right, wasn't it? And he went, yeah, I thought it went really well.
You didn't say Bowie was a twat.
Thank God that... fuck that guy, you know. But, so we're walking and we're just chatting And he says, I don't know how it began, but he tells me this story. He says, I wish I could remember what I said to prompt him to tell this story. But anyway, he said, you know, Joey and I were at home one night in Geneva or wherever they lived.
Yeah.
He said, and the film of Ziggy Stardust, Kenny Baker made a famous film from the 73 Farewell show, but it didn't go on general release for over 10 years. And he said, we were at home one night, obviously pre-Google, they're looking at the local paper.
Yeah.
He said, we noticed it was on in town and we had nothing to do. It was like a boring Wednesday night. And we both said, shall we go?
Whoa.
He said, Joey was like 16 at the time or something like that. And so David said, yeah, let's go. So Joey goes, I've got to go and get ready first. So Bowie's like, well, hurry up because, you know, it starts at 8 or whatever it is. So Joey runs up the stairs. He's gone for ages and half an hour, 45 minutes. And David's going, Joey, come on, we've got to go. Finally, Joey comes down the stairs. He's been in his dad's old wardrobe. He's dug out all the Ziggy clothes.
Yeah.
He's put on makeup and styled his hair. And he's coming down the stairs in the full Ziggy outfit.
Regalia.
Bloody hell. And David goes, the first words out of my mouth were, you're not going out looking like that.
Ah, brilliant. That's amazing.
He goes, this reminded me of the Exploited meeting. He goes, and at that point, my head went, oh, no, how can you? Oh, yes, oh, no, oh, God. It was like one side of my brain. I thought, oh, fuck, here we go again. You know? And but the other side of my brain, you know.
This is why we do this podcast, Mick. Stories like that, you are just gold. You cannot get them anywhere. Maximum round of applause for you for that.
And Lynott said to me,
Mick, are you into Fleetwood Mac?
That's a terrible...
Ian,
cut that. Are you into Fleetwood Mac? I can't. Fuck me. I'm Irish. And I can't. Okay, I'm not going to do it.
No, I think it was more like, are you into Fleetwood Mac? That there kind of go. Like aggressive southern
thing. He was more of a smoothie. He was,
are you into Fleetwood Mac? I was like, Phil.
You sound like Sean Connery, mate. Are you into Fleetwood
fuck
Mac?
Off,
money,
Sean Connery. Are you into Fleetwood Mac?
Is any of this going to make it in?
Yes,
if it does, thank you so much for listening to us. We do appreciate it. It gets better.
No, Ian, leave all this in for crying out loud.
Leave all this in.
Now, that's a northern Irish accent. Phil famously was from Dublin.
He was from Dublin.
Crumlin in Dublin.
He was
and
Crumlin.
He said, Mick,
do not edit this out.
Will you shut up talking to me? Oh, fuck's sake. He said, are you into Fleetwood Mac? And I was about 20 years old at the time. And I went, well, I really like the early stuff with Pink and Green.
I love the chain.
And he went, ha, 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 come here. And he pulled out a white packet.
Bloody hell.
And he unfolded it, and with a plectrum, he dug out a big load of powder.
A goodly portion.
Goodly portion. I went to shove it under my nose, and I was no stranger to such activities back then. However, there was something odd about this particular powder, and I said, oh, what is it? And he went, Fleetwood Mac.
God.
Smack. And I went, No.
Yeah.
And then he went, I don't offer this to just anybody.
Christ.
So I did it.
Did you?
I did, yeah.
You realise that's both illegal and dangerous?
It was back then, and it still is now, and do not do this at home.
Kids.
We're on the road on the Monsters of Rock tour in America in 89, and, you know, Kirk's kind of a hippie, and so am I.
Surfer dude, yeah.
This is the 80s, you know, we're all vegetarian and new agey, and me and Kirk are coming down in the lift to the bar to go out and kick ass. And we're talking about essential oils. and literally, I'm explaining to him how lavender was called a medicine chest in a bottle.
Yeah.
Like if you've got a headache, you just rub some on your temples or perhaps your wrist.
And he was well into this.
Oh, we're well into this. But at this point, the lift stops at a certain floor. The door's open and in comes James Hetfield. And I'm like, you know what also is really nice, Kirk, is neroli. Have you tried neroli? Oh, I love the fragrance of neroli. And Kirk's going, I don't know what you're talking about, man. I mean, shut up. And I'm thinking, no, neroli, you know. And James Hetfield is looking. He's like,
what the hell, buddy?
I realised I was being inappropriate.
That's brilliant, though.
Dead rock stars lobbing light grenades into the gloom.
Rick's best friends, in inverted commas, in the late 70s were George Best and Alex Hurricane Higgins.
Bloody hell.
So this is what we're talking about. Page Three Girls, cocaine,
that's
champagne.
That's a night out, isn't it? Fucking hell.
Well, Rick believed in big nights out. I mean, I'm jumping around as usual here, but in 97, when he had his first heart attack,
yeah,
his first of three. It led to him having a quadruple bypass. And while he was in the private ward of the hospital, he and Francis told me it was like a Carry-On movie because Rick would be in there with his girlfriend.
Yeah.
And then they'd have to sneak the girlfriend out a side door because his wife was about to arrive.
Bloody hell.
So then he'd have his wife in there. He's had the quadruple bypass. He's lying in bed with all the wires coming out of it. Then she would be ushered out and he would take the whole caboodle. He'd get out of bed, you know, the whole contraption.
Sort of, drip thing and walk around with it.
Drag it to the gents, smoke some cigarettes, come back. He was supposed to be in there for 2 months. He checked himself out after 3 weeks because he was bored. And he told me that very night, because he's talked like that, you know, he said, I hadn't had a big night in ages. So I thought, you know, I'm due a big night. So he got a roadie to carry him into his house, lay him on the couch, then go out and buy him a quarter ounce of Coke.
Jeez.
Carton of 200 cigarettes, 4 bottles of champagne. I said, so what, did you have people over? He said, no, just me and the bird, you know, just having a big night.
This is right after surgery.
This is 3 weeks after quadruple bypass, yeah.
You have to admire it, don't you?
He was back on stage a month after that.
You know, in some ways you have to admire this. If I had a quadruple bypass, I wouldn't leave the sofa for fucking 20 years. I'd milk the most out of it.
Certainly we've been having 7 grams of cocaine, no. Angus never drank or took a drug in his life. Malcolm loved his booze and his smoke and his toot and all the rest of it, but mainly the booze, you know, and a man's man. And that was all good. But I think once you get to your late 20s, early 30s, I know in my life there was a moment where I just didn't want to hang out with 22-year-old headbangers anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
I actually did read books. I actually did know the difference between a Bordeaux and
a Merlot.
I was going to say a Liebfraumilch.
Okay, yeah.
So not only did he not hang out with them, not only did he live in a separate place to them because they would share houses in London, on the road, he quite often travelled with the support band. So who were they opening for? Probably Aerosmith or someone like that in the 78 or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Dave Menichetti from Y&T, they were like the opening band on the bill. And he told me he had a great memory of they'd just finished their set, this huge outdoor Enormo dome in the summer in America, you know.
Yeah.
And next one were AC/DC for 45 minutes and then it would be Aerosmith or whoever for, you know, an hour and a half. And they were panicking because no Bon. Where's Bon? When did you last see him? I don't know, last night. You know, what was he doing? And literally with 5 minutes to go before on stage, and they're at some desert place in Arizona or something, they see this cloud of dust coming at speed towards the stadium. And it's literally two trucks, open back trucks, Mexicans, and it's all and here's Bon on the back of the truck with a bottle in each hand, no shirt. And they're going, Bon, where have you been? Where have you gone? Oh, come on, mate, let's fucking do the show.
Straight on.
Straight on.
Didn't do his vocal warm-ups.
No, his vocal warm-ups were to gargle Jack Daniels and
bloody hell, man.
I mean, Ian Jeffrey, the tour manager, wonderful guy who him and Bon used to share a room.
Yeah.
And he said, I don't know why they put beds in our room because we didn't sleep for about 3 years. He just said, can you imagine sharing a room with Bon Scott in AC/DC?
Sorry, Mick. So we quite often in these podcasts jump to the sort of the sad years without spending the time I would like to spend on the big, happy, good mental times. Was his thing booze or coke or both?
Everything.
So was he taking smack at this point?
Everything.
Bloody
when hell. He was in fraternity. Similar to AC/DC, if you know the AC/DC story, they came to London.
Yeah.
They were big in Australia. In order to make it in the UK, they came and all lived, like Australians do, came and all lived in a big house in Earl's Court.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Straight with Mike. That hemisphere is fucked.
What's less well known is that just 3 years before, Bon had done exactly the same thing with fraternity.
Mm.
They lived in Norwood or somewhere like that.
Yeah.
And again, you know, typical squat hippie house. But fraternity, from the name, you can tell they were a hippie band. I mean,
right.
Bon would play flute. I mean, for goodness sake,
that
you know.
That's mad, isn't it?
But his nickname in the group was Road Test Ronnie. Because any drug that came in the house, if they were a little bit iffy, Bon would take it.
Yeah.
Again, you've got to remember, no internet, all right?
No.
So what you relied on with your dealers was whatever happened to come their way. I mean, in this country these days, I do not take drugs, haven't done for many years. But these days, most of the weed in this country is made in this country. It's done by people that have marijuana farms under hydroponic lights, and they make incredibly strong weed. Back in the late 70s, none of that went on. It was always imported.
Afghan so, sort of stuff.
Absolutely. You get some guy coming in going, oh, I've got a nice bit of Rocky Moroccan. I've got a nice bit of Afghani. Yeah, obviously. And then,
was he quite camp then?
He was this guy, yeah. It was just this one guy who used to service everybody in London.
He serviced everyone?
He did.
Mate, what the hell are you talking about?
Oh, I remember that one of my, that I read about once, was called... I've got some nice Nepalese temple ball. You're going to love it. You see, it's black and the white streaks, that's opium. And everybody go, opium.
Man, that's so exotic.
Yeah. But at the same time, they'd come in with powders and pills and go, nah, this was made by a German scientist in 74, but it got stolen from his laboratory. So today what I've got, and this is the stuff that Hendrix took when he made Electric Ladyland. I mean, you have these conversations.
Great days, great
and people
days.
Would go, wow, so, okay. But of course, this sometimes resulted in death. I mean, Lemmy has great stories of bikers turning up with all kinds of chemical compounds that would actually kill you or make your hair fall out.
He had this story, didn't he, about how a friend of his died in his arms after taking a drug that was laced with rat poison.
Wow.
If you recall that story.
Wow.
It's either in my book or your book or someone else's
book. Was it Moroccan
book.
Rat poison? Or?
Yeah, only the best.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
The bloke literally died, said, I'm going to die, Lem, I'm going to die. And he did die. So
well,
it was all awful. Really.
People did die, you know. So, I mean...
Which makes Ronnie the road test.
Road test Ronnie.
A bit of a...
So, and lunatic, Australians
lunatic
in London, can you imagine? So lunatics from
I'll
all over...
I'll try it, mate.
Yeah,
stick it up my nose.
Yeah, crazy Phil was here. He's from that Scott in Ladbroke Grove. Yeah, you guys are lightweights. You won't like this. Give it a road test, Ronnie. Here, Ronnie, what do you reckon? Fuck that. Give it to me, mate. Way. And if Ronnie was still alive the next day, they'd all get stuck
in. They'd all pile in.
This isn't a record you put on to go, oh, I love this. This will cheer me up. You know, this is the difference between, in terms of art, this is the difference between a Michelangelo, where you just admire the technique, you admire the substance, but it's figurative and you can, it's good on the eye and you can follow it, to a Jackson Pollock, where people go, well, what the fuck's that? Mm. Guy's just throwing fucking paint.
Yeah. No, I grasp this.
You're right on one level. The guy is throwing paint.
Yeah.
But actually, there's a method to his madness. But this is the dividing line between Lou Reed and, shall we say, Susie Quattro.
All right.
You know, similar period.
Yeah.
This is the dividing line between Lou Reed and Mick Jagger. Let's put it like that. This is the dividing line between Lou Reed and David Bowie until David Bowie somewhat emulated with that approach with Low, particularly Side 2.
Yeah.
If you've been listening to Stockhausen.
Yeah, right.
If you've been listening to Berlioz or, you know, trust me, what Lou Reed did didn't come out of nowhere. And yes, of course, it's veiled in contempt. It's veiled in self-loathing. It's a high art joke in many ways. It's an insult in many ways. Nevertheless, he did it. No one else did it. And we're still talking about it today. We're still debating it today.
I love talking about this album. I remember there's a magazine called Terrorizer, which is an extreme metal thing. And they once ran a poll saying, which is the most extreme album ever recorded? People clearly wrote in and said, it's Slayer, it's Morbid Angel.
Kill 'em all!
And so on and so on. Yeah. But actually, they wrote themselves that they thought the Metal Machine Music was the most extreme album ever made. Now, that showed serious intelligence and a little bit of stepping outside the box. But I have a question for you. I can see you're about to talk, which is why I want to say it. We can defend or not defend the artistic merit of this album all day, and I love doing that. Would you defend its musical quality?
Of course, yeah.
You like the sounds on the record. Forget the artistic
value. I didn't say I like the sound. You said, is there anything to defend about the musicality?
Yeah, okay.
Yes, of course.
Do you like the sounds that you hear when they come off the record?
Liking sounds doesn't mean defending musicality.
Right. Simple
Are
question.
You saying... No, it's not...
Do you like listening to the album?
No.
Does anyone?
Probably Lou Reed used to like listening to it.
So my point is only this, that this is where we find a brilliant, brilliant turning point or a sort of a catalyst for discussing something's musical merit as opposed to its artistic merit, which to me are completely different. I love the fact that he released it, don't get me wrong. I love the fact that he recorded it, that they made it a double album just to take the piss even more. But I think it's utter bollocks at the same time. That's what fascinates me.
See, I don't agree with you.
What's your take?
No, I totally disagree.
Let's have it.
I totally disagree. I think what you're talking about is a visceral, immediate reaction. But if you listen to great jazz music or great classical music or any of the great electronic composers, yeah. you listen to Philip Glass, you know, you listen to Steve Reich, you listen to On the Beach, you know, you listen to some of those, they don't even know what to call them because they're not classical, they're not jazz, they're avant-garde.
Yeah.
Moments of silence, you know, is that musicality? Is that something to think about in the same way you think about art? Just because I don't like it or I think it's bollocks, I think says more about the listener than it does about the piece of work. The fact is, it's a statement and you can dismiss it, you can get angry with it, you can call it bollocks, but you can do that to all kinds of art. There are still people today that look at abstract art and go, well, that's bollocks.
Yeah.
Tracy Ehrman's bed.
Yeah,
well, I could have done that.
Yeah, yeah,
no, I couldn't.
No, and believe me, I despise that knee-jerk reaction myself. The point I was only making was that I thought the music was crap, but that it was a wonderful artistic statement that I'm glad
the
was made.
The music was crap.
Oh, yeah. God, yeah.
No, I can't. No, I totally disagree.
Okay.
I fundamentally disagree. You're imposing your own idea of what
yes.
good and bad
yeah.
is.
As a subjective listener, I feel I can.
But what are you comparing it to? So what piece of electronic avant-garde art music would you say was better and why?
I wouldn't. Because
so
I know
you're not
how it
really
was produced.
Engaging with what it is. You're saying, I listened to it, I thought it was bollocks.
I took the time to listen to it all the way through.
Once, and decided it was bollocks.
I decided that I wouldn't assign any merit to it musically. Artistically is a different matter. Musically, because I know I could sit down there with a couple of pedals and a guitar and do it myself. Perhaps that's the wrong view, but that was my view.
Could you sit down and do the same to a Metallica record?
Could I play the stuff on a Metallica album? Yeah, of course.
Yeah, but it wouldn't sound like Metallica, would it?
No, it wouldn't. But Metallica plunges a lot of technicality and artistry into it, which I admire.
That's all.
I think we're going around in circles. I mean,
here's the thing. You said it's bollocks.
Musically,
why don't we stick
not
to that?
Artistically. Musically, not artistically.
Say it again.
Musically, I think it sounds terrible. Artistically, I think it's fantastic.
Okay.
That's my view.
And here's my view.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Totally disagree.
Go on.
I've already gone on.
So
how many times have I got to go
because
on?
Because I don't understand what you're saying. Are you saying?
Well, you're
that,
never going to understand.
Well,
it.
Try it one more time. Try me one more time. Are you saying that musically, actually, this is pretty good stuff?
Musically, I think it's a fantastic, unrepeatable statement. And if you look at the tradition it comes out of, it fits extremely well. And at that time in the history of rock music, it was an extraordinary thing to do.
That I don't disagree with at all.
But when you say musically it's bollocks, that's like saying, well, it's not catchy. You know, it's like saying, I can't hum it. It's like saying, well, there's no chorus. I mean,
okay.
What I'm saying to you is, you've made your statement, it's bollocks. Here's my statement. No, it isn't.
Yeah, okay.
Okay?
And this is what's wonderful about it, right? In this case, it's a fairly extreme example of what would pass for a double LP from a... You know what I mean?
It's
an extreme statement. It is.
I'm not going to join you on any of this.
Okay.
It's an extreme statement if you happen to be listening to the Rolling Stones that day or you want something that is much more accessible and within your own parameters of what rock music
contextually,
is.
Contextually, okay.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Dead Rock Stars with Mick Wall and Joel McIver.
Everybody wanted to work with Jimmy. Everybody yeah. wanted to get a contact high.
Yeah, right. Nicely put.
And I think that when it comes to Hendrix, because we talk about Beyond the Sky and the yeah. other side of the rainbow and that, it's very hard to say anything without sounding trite and punning. Sure. But, you know, the sky was the limit. It yeah. really was.
yeah.
And the whole thing about his death, we could do a whole podcast purely on the night he died.
We could.
But there are many, many conflicting stories. Some say it was drugs, he got sick in his sleep. Others talk of evidence of him being pumped with red wine.
If there was a coroner's report, what did it say?
Well, we mention coroner's reports a lot, don't we?
And we
you
do.
Know, you know, I have
sadly,
a very,
we do.
I have a very low opinion of coroner's reports. I don't know off the top of my head. Someone will write in and let us know. But it was a typical misadventure.
I think aspiration, you know, of his vomit is a kind of known thing.
Asphyxiation.
Well, yeah. yeah. They talk about aspirating your own right. vomit and asphyxiating on it. But what led to that, I guess, is the question, right?
Well, there are people saying he was still alive when they got him to the hospital. There were people saying he was already dead. You know, Monica Dannemann, who was his girlfriend and then eventually spent the rest of her life with Uli John Roth,
yeah.
was convinced that, you know, it was a conspiracy to kill Jimmy by Mike Jeffrey.
Right. So talk about that. And now, a few years ago, you were editing a Hendrix special for Classic Rock magazine, and you asked me to review a book written by James Tappy Wright, who had been one of Hendrix's roadies. And in Mr. Wright's book, he said very clearly that Jimmy had been murdered, not, I believe, by Mike Jeffrey himself, but by his people.
Mm.
By pouring, I don't know, 3 bottles of red wine down his throat until he vomited. Mm. I can't remember the exact details, but like maybe choking him while he vomited or just ensuring that he did not survive the vomit.
And I think his assertion was because Jeffries had him insured for a lot of money.
In order to make a lot of money out of the insurance money that he would get from Jimmy not fulfilling his obligations as a touring artist. Right?
I think also he'd reconciled himself, if that's the word, to the fact that Jimmy wasn't going to be doing his bidding anymore.
I mean, this is a huge claim to make. Now, Mike Jeffrey was long dead when this book came out.
Mm.
James Wright himself has subsequently died.
Mm.
And he was very, very clear in his book. He said, this is what happened. Mm. I think he cited an eyewitness whose name I can't remember. But he said, this is what happened. Jimmy was murdered for an insurance claim. Now, what did we do with that information, you know, all these years later?
Well, we do know that just a few months before that, Jimi Hendrix was kidnapped in New York.
Tell us about that.
Which, again, people attribute to Mike Jeffrey, although this kidnapping was allegedly done by members of the Mafia, who, it is said, some say, on Mike Jeffrey's bidding. Now, whether it was to scare the bejesus out of Jimmy, but shortly after that, he embarks on his experience tour. I think he was gone for like 3 to 5 days, something like that. And of course, you know, the media coverage of such things is so minimal in those days compared to now.
Yeah.
You can't look out the window these days without it being all over social media.
Yeah.
Hendrix kidnapped for 5 days. But yes, it happened. And yeah, it freaked the shit out of everybody.
This is all proven and known.
Yeah, absolutely,
right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I didn't just make it up. What? Stop looking at him.
Wait, he's going to say something.
Here we go.
So his stomach was pumped full of red wine, but he hadn't had time to metabolize it, which is why there was none in his bloodstream.
According to the surgeon, Dr. Bannister, he said that Hendrix's body was full
his
of red
stomach
wine.
Stomach was full of red wine.
Absolutely overflowing with red wine.
But
the alcohol content in his blood was minimal.
Right, so therefore the wine cannot have been in his stomach very long.
Right.
Before he died.
Right.
And he stated that Jimmy must have drowned from this.
Right. And so, and Tappy claims that they shoved gallons
of
this
stuff
down his neck. Yeah.
And it's consistent with Tappy's claim. That's what the surgeon thought. So maybe Jimmy was murdered, you know, maybe he was.
I think people overlook or simply aren't aware of just how dodgy music biz and showbiz was.
Oh, man.
In the 60s.
The list of monstrous managers goes on and on, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, and organized crime, particularly in America, remains a feature, if truth be known. But particularly in those Wild West days where people aren't pulling out credit cards for tickets or records, they're paying cash.
Mm-hmm.
And these are usually poor people making the records.
Yeah, yeah,
They're not smart cookies. Hendrix had been running around like the runt of the litter for most of his life. Now he's a big star. It could just disappear tomorrow, And the way he was spending money and people were spending his money for him. I mean, Hendrix never owned a house.
Really?
Never owned a house, never owned a car. You know, he would sleep on the floor or someone's spare room, or he'd have an apartment briefly in New York with some chick. Him and Kathy in London, I think, was the closest he ever got to domesticity. And even that was, you know, a young couple having a good time.
Going back to the night of his death, Monica discovered him, right?
That's how the story goes.
Lemmy maintained that she was at fault for not putting Jimmy in the recovery position.
Right.
Which may or may not be relevant. God, Lemmy would know. Oh, Lemmy was, on an unrelated note, Lemmy the following day was going to go and audition as Hendrix's bass player.
Wow.
What a fantastic thing. That's what Lemmy said.
Lemmy was such a fibber sometimes.
You're right, but he was saying
this. Did Jimmy know he was coming?
He was saying this in the context of a very sad story about Jimmy's death, so I imagine it wouldn't be the time to throw in a kind of a quip, you know what I mean?
Right.
All right, well, what happened, mate? What was the cause of the, what happened?
Well, there's lots of stories. There are stories about the two pilots smoking weed and sharing a bottle of bourbon.
Okay.
What actually happened was the engine that caught fire on the previous flight caught fire again and stopped. And although they had just refueled, they'd literally just refueled and taken off. They were suddenly perilously close to being out of fuel.
Yeah.
So either the thing was leaking fuel, which maybe helped cause the fire, who knows?
Yes.
But the second engine then died.
Christ.
And I was reading about this, and this next bit is really chilling, because I hadn't thought it through. I hadn't realised, but the two pilots go into the rest of the plane, only a small plane, tell them what's happened. Both engines are dead, and at this point we are in free fall. I suggest you get pillows, put your head between your knees, and buckle up tight. And it took them over 10 minutes to hit the ground.
Good Lord.
Ronnie was asleep. They woke him up because he needed to get his seatbelt on.
Mm.
And he was like, just let me sleep, man. And they're like, but Ronnie, the plane's going down. He gets up, walks to the back of the plane, finds himself a pillow. On his way, he grins. He looks at one of the guys. I forget which one it was. Maybe Ed. He looks at one of the guys, grins at him and shakes his hand. And he said, Ronnie knew he was going to die.
Jesus.
Gets the pillow, back in the seat. And 10 minutes later, 10 of the longest minutes you can ever imagine. Apparently it was dead quiet, other than people pleading to God to spare their lives. A lot of sobbing.
God.
And Ronnie just sitting there, not a word. And plane comes down at 90 miles an hour.
Skimming some trees over.
Which take off the wings, burst open the fuselage, separate the pilot cabin from the body of the plane. The tail comes off, still move in. By the time it stopped, Ronnie Van Zandt was already dead. Blunt force trauma to the head. He went straight into a tree.
At 90 miles an hour?
Yeah. And the two pilots, both dead, they were still strapped into their chairs, but the chairs had been ripped out of the plane and were actually hanging upside down from trees.
Christ. It's like a horror film, isn't it? I can't think of a worse scenario.
And of course, with all horrors, there's this tiny bit of bleak humour, which is that famously their drummer at the time, the fabulously named Artemus Pyle, was in with the pilots when the second engine went and they were maydaying. They were already maydaying, in fact, for somewhere to land. And the second engine went. And Artemus Pyle's father was a pilot who had died in a plane crash. Yeah. And he said he could tell just looking at the pilots, he said they had death in their eyes. They'd clearly never, ever experienced anything like that before. They didn't have any training with what to do. One of the guys also on the plane, whose name tragically escapes me right this second, but apparently he went through to the pilots during the 10 minutes when they're whistling through the air.
Yeah.
Because there was no sound. The engines were gone. All they said they could hear was their own plane whistling through the air.
God.
He went through and said to them, I hope you motherfuckers survive, because after this, I'm going to kill you both.
Are we right in saying that he exploded onto the worldwide scene with Purple Rain? That was when it all...
I think that was when he burst onto the scene.
Yeah, okay.
I think that's when he exploded.
Did the film come at the same time as the album, or was it a bit later, or what was the score?
1984. Now, I remember this very, very well because I was a champion of that record and that movie. Crusher Jewel,
yeah,
who was the designer on Kerrang!
And
magazine.
Legend, rock legend.
Well, legend to be. He wasn't in 1984. In 1984, he was still Steve Jewel, and he wore these glasses that looked like your grandmother's, and it was me that dragged him out of his shell and started calling him Crusher. He did have that as a nickname, but no one ever used it because, honestly, this was like visiting your auntie when you saw him, Steve or Stephen. It was later that he then developed this wonderful persona. But it was already there, the craziness. And the Kerrang! Office was in Covent Garden. Of course, no social media, no video even.
Yeah.
So if you wanted to see the movie, you went to the movie theatre. And it was showing in Leicester Square, and it was on for about a month. And Crusher and I went to see it 9 times.
Oh, wow.
3 of those times tripping heavily.
Really?
Yeah.
Like falling over things?
Well, the 3rd time, Crusher was evicted from the theatre because he was literally running around the whole thing. He was having a freak out, running around going, rock, 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 yeah, yeah. And I'm going, cool it, man, cool it, man.
Dude. Calm down, are you English?
The pigs.
They're making a scene.
So literally these ushers, these like old lady ushers are running after him with torches. On the
Sit
screen,
down, young
on
man.
The screen it's, you know, when doves cry, dim, 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 yeah, yeah, and all these torches following him. Finally they get him, tackle him to the ground, and don't forget he's tripping on heavy duty mescaline.
He's quite tall, isn't he? He's a big lad, isn't he? He's quite tall. I've met him. Maybe he's grown since those days. Come on, continue with the story.
Are you sure you weren't tripping?
Come on, so they wrestled him to the ground and that was the end of it.
Threw him out. So I'm left there on my own, tripping out of my brain, thinking...
Sure, that's not legal.
Surely there's some way out of here.
There must be some kind of way out of here.
Yeah, and there wasn't. I stayed till the end, found my way to the tube somehow. But that's another story. The point is we became obsessed with the movie and the album and... it was all simultaneous because When Doves Cry was the first single and the video for
Of course,
Doves
it has bits of the film in it.
All of the film is in it. You know, it's like a trailer for the movie. The bit on the bike and all that stuff, that's all in the movie.
Can I tell you my favourite scene?
Is it the bit where
she... Yes. First, you have to purify yourself in the waters of Lake Minnetonka. And she does, first removing her top. Now, I was 13 or something when this
Wasn't
film came
all
out.
Her clothes? I thought it was all her clothes.
No, she retains the bottom dignity.
Does she? I don't think she retains much dignity.
Me and my friend Phil, I'll give my friend Phil a big name check here, who introduced me to Prince and was a huge, huge Prince fan. He had it on video. And we would incessantly watch that scene in our feverish little teenage way.
She was a big boned girl.
Insanely beautiful, that woman. And that was my moment. I tell you, I was very confused and happy about that for many years to come.
Well, I ended up having the movie on video and watched it about another 100 times. Mm. And I have to say,
pause button, bro.
She was in many of my favourite scenes. But yeah. Mainly, you know why?
Do tell.
Good singer.
Oh, she's a great singer.
Yeah. but that was a great movie. And don't forget, he wrote that.
It's unexpectedly a great movie. Surely the odds would be stacked against it.
Oh,
you know?
It should have been absolutely.
And yeah, it was great.
Shit.
He got an Oscar for it, didn't he?
Yeah.
As well as the associated Grammys and stuff. But that film was... So outrageous, so brilliant, so not really that true, I don't think.
Yeah, but that, you know? When has truth had anything
When's
to do with...
When has it ever interfered with a good film, right?
You see, the thing is, there's truth, and then there's ultimate truth.
Man, that's deep.
Well, you can watch The Simpsons and go, well, it's just a cartoon. No, mate, there's a lot of truth going on here.
Mm-hmm.
Why I think that movie was so ultimately brilliant was because, of course, it was ridiculous and over the top and hilarious. But that time when you see him on stage, he's got no shirt on, he's got a blindfold.
Oh, yeah.
And he's singing and doing... That, to me, is truth, because that ain't an MTV video. That's actually him on stage doing something he would do on stage. He's also, you want to look for deeper levels, he's also referencing Jimi Hendrix's performance at Woodstock, where he had a guitarist on stage... A black guitarist on stage, completely blindfolded. Especially if you're tripping, you know, you can find a lot of significance in that movie. There's truth in there.
I like it, man.
Truth.
And there's that whole thing with him and Morris Day, And what was the club called? Fifth Avenue. I always wanted to go there and see the beautiful people who were rather different from rural Somerset, where I was grown up, surrounded by pig farmers and their offspring. The album, the album starts with Let's Go Crazy, which has that all-time great intro.
Dearly beloved.
Get through this thing called life. Electric word. Life means rare as my long time. And at the end of that song, he does that insane Eddie Van Halen style solo.
I don't remember that.
Go straight into.
Are you sure you weren't tripping?
Go straight into Darling Nikki, as I recall.
Yeah.
Another amazing song which had a very rude
word
in it.
About masturbation.
It did. It had. I met her in the hotel lobby.
Where she was masturbating with a magazine.
Yes.
Yeah.
And apparently that was quite shocking at the time. Enough for.
I'd say that was fairly shocking now.
Who was that?
Can you imagine if you're watching. Not that I would. You'd have to stab me in both eyes if you caught me. But if you're watching The X Factor. So what are you going to do for us, love? I'm going to do Darling Nikki by Prince. Oh, go for it. A man is the pure cold Nikki. Masturbating with a man.
You can't say that.
Yeah, right.
Because I've never masturbated.
Where was I going with that? Tipper Gore.
PMRC took objection.
He was one of the filthy 15.
They mentioned that line in court. Mm. I was.
No, American way.
Hey, I was reading this with my daughter. I was reading the Bible with my daughter. And
Bible study class.
She showed me. The lyric sheet from this album.
It has M-word.
And I couldn't believe my eyes. I had to seek therapy from my therapist.
Barbara. I'm shocked.
I mean, I just had to drop another Quaalude and have a whiskey. I mean, yes, I often masturbate with magazines, but I wouldn't put it in a song and play it to my children of God.
I wrote a long piece once about the Parents Music Resource Centre, PMRC, from Metal Hammer years ago. And it was a big piece on censorship in music, so I went back to Elvis and so on and so on. And when I got to the 80s, it was just hilarious, this nonsensical satanic panic that had America up in arms, certain parts of America, not the more liberal parts that we know and love. And Prince, of course, you look back now, God, it's all so innocent. Yes, he wore a G-string, and yes, he used the word masturbate. Oh, my God. Were we all idiots back then, or what?
No, of course not. That's why 9 million people bought that record and why he won an Oscar for the movie.
Yeah.
People in the PMRC, they were the idiots. And, of course, you know, it's news.
Politicians.
It's a link on TV
them.
Or the news channel, you know.
Tipper Gore. Al Gore's wife.
Yeah.
Why they didn't tell her to fuck off, I don't know.
Do you know what? People did tell her to fuck off because none of these careers ended. You know, the sweet irony was that as soon as you got one of those stickers on your record, it was like a badge of honour.
Yeah.
It's like now, these days, I mean, I sit at home and you're watching TV and it go, the following programme contains scenes of sex
you may find
and violence.
Distressing. Yeah.
No, sex and I'm like, booyah!
Is it?
This is my shit! This is my people! Excellent! I only want programmes have sex and violence
from
and
the outset.
Disturbing scenes from the outset and filthy language.
From the credit.
From the outset.
In the credit.
You want that shit.
It's just bollocks, isn't it? This was the era of Mike Reed refusing to play Relax by Frankie as well. I hated all that. Even when I was 12 years old, I knew this was all bullshit.
Dead rock stars. They did it, so we don't have to.
You referred earlier to her status as a feminist rock icon and how that felt a little bit patronising, a little bit odd, and I agree with that because she hardly lived a life which was an example to us all by dying of a drug overdose at the age of 27. Conversely, she fought that gender identity war and won because she did commercially and critically very, very well.
Mm.
She sang in an incredibly, I don't want to say aggressive way, but it was full of energy and vim.
Very forceful.
Very forceful, very powerful. You listened to her, didn't you? And you watched her. So she stamped her mark on, as you were saying, a really masculine music scene. That's got to be an inspiration for today's, you know, women and girls who are musicians or wanting to be musicians. I totally get that, and I'm glad she exists in that sense. What's gutting is that she couldn't make the ultimate triumph and live a long and productive, happy life.
I think also it reflects well on rock music because...
yeah.
I don't care if this sounds patronising, but it occurs to me that unlike Grace Slick, who was beautiful and desirable in the conventional sense, Janis wasn't in the conventional sense, but she created a space that hadn't existed before.
Right, a pioneer.
an absolute pioneer. Okay, it was through her demons, her insecurities. Well, you could say that about Sinatra or Elvis or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay, there are reasons she was like she was. But the fact is, before Janis, there wasn't anybody like her. There were some big-boned old black
jazz
blues
and soul
singers.
Soul singers.
But in terms of rock and pop and that whole area, she created a space that did not exist before. Mama Cass was around the same time. Mama Cass loved her, was there at Monterey.
Yeah.
But Mama Cass was in a group who wrote California Dreaming.
Different music entirely.
And they also had a beautiful blonde girl in the group. Yeah, you know, there was a, it was Offset.
Yeah.
She did have a solo career, but Janis was so, you know, I hate when people use that word iconic because they totally overuse it.
Yeah.
If you listen to Six Music, all these people you've never heard of, all iconic, people use it now as a way of saying, well, you've never heard of him and he never sold any fucking records, but completely iconic in the hip hop community. You
Ted Rogers was iconic on 3-2-1.
No, he was iconic. Yeah. Joel's just doing the little
3-2-1.
Yeah, that's easy. Go on, do it again. How do you do it?
No, I fucked up. No, I can't do it. It doesn't really work for podcasts.
No, know, no, but I, you know. So I think Janis.
She's dead, Ted Rogers.
She,
could we do him on this?
Maybe. So she did this thing that hadn't been done before. She left a door open, but who did walk through?
Well, that was my next question. Okay, in the 80s. The biggest pop artist in the world was Madonna, right? But that's about a long way away.
About as opposite to Janis as you could possibly get, except maybe in attitude.
Right, her forceful character.
Beating the guys at their own game.
Yeah, totally. And then beyond that, into the 90s, you had, well, the obvious cliched suggestion is Alanis Morissette, but that there were a lot of very, very strong women in the 90s.
Or Courtney Love.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah. So from, you know, in the 80s and 90s on, you had these very strong
Amy Winehouse in more recent times.
So, but in the 70s, in the wake of her death, I can't think of a woman rocker, particularly, unless I'm missing out completely.
Susie Quattro.
Susie Quattro, she is a good example.
Yeah, and also Susie Sue from the Banshees.
Yeah, what did you say?
Sue.
Ah, sorry, I was thinking of Susie. I thought you said Susie Q, so that's what I said.
That's what I thought
Quattro,
you said as well, yeah.
This is why producers shouldn't fucking talk.
Interrupt when the talent is creating.
Now, Susie Quattro came up in the early 70s, right?
But she wasn't Janis. She was an Osmonds version of the Janis.
Yeah, in a kind of, with a sort of rock facade, I guess, right?
She was pop music. Maybe people made a big deal about, it's this girl in black leather, you know. Yeah, doing fucking pop hits written by the same people that write songs for Smokey and Mudd.
Chin and Chapman.
Yeah, great pop songs, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
But give me a break.
All right, so who followed in her footsteps then? Has anyone ever really done it? There are quite a few female singers nowadays who sing in an extremely extravagant way.
I think there are extraordinary female musical personalities now.
Yeah.
There are ladies that have inverted the triangle, as you might say. They've belied the conventional idea.
Defeated the paradigm?
That's where I'm aiming for.
Just ask me if you've got any vocab problems.
Alison Moyet.
Yeah, all right, yeah.
Yeah, because she was a big pop icon when she exploded onto the scene. But, you know, she was not Britney Spears, you know.
It's true.
It's true. And there are lots of other examples, I think, particularly over the last sort of 10 or 20 years. Courtney Love, definitely in that space, although Courtney played on her sexuality a little more obviously.
The Riot Girl bands, they were full of energy and aggression.
There you go.
And they dominated their space.
L7 were great.
Yeah.
Also, in the early 70s, there was a group called Fanny.
Yeah.
Who were June and Jean Millington, the sisters, who I really fancied the arse off, Jean.
If you're listening, Jean, get
She was a bass player, actually, Joel.
Of course, they're always the hottest.
Yeah, of course they are.
I suppose what I'm leaning towards, in the absence of us
leaning towards?
In the absence of us coming up with loads of candidates who followed in Janis's footsteps, is that maybe she was just way ahead of the curve by like a decade or two. There wasn't really a successor to her who looked or sounded like her for quite some time.
No, there wasn't. No.
So she was alone in that sense. I don't know who it was. Someone said that the pioneers get all the arrows, and she did. The term creative capital was introduced to me a few years ago by a member of the industry who said that bands, in fact, anyone who's a creative, is blessed or born with a certain amount of creative capital, right? It's what bands run out of. They all do. We all do. Everyone does.
No,
some point.
I don't.
No, maybe not you, but
not
everyone
me.
Else.
Yeah,
yeah. You're the Bowie of singing.
Now, I see you very Bolan-esque in that regard.
I am quite like Mark Bolan in many ways.
I've often gone, Mark, I mean, Joel.
it's,
Especially now you've lost a lot of weight.
Oh, yeah, I'm barely visible. If I stand sideways, you wouldn't see me.
No.
That's what my wife says.
That's right.
Creative capital is what deserts us, and they, as musicians, start writing shit music.
I think musicians, definitely. I think writers get more powerful often.
I like that.
Yeah, musicians, they're fucked after 25. But writers don't even get going till they're at least...
31.
50.
So the point I'm trying to make is that he did, in fact, have an incredibly transcendent period, right? He knocked out all these killer singles one by one.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And then nothing really after that, and that was it. The drugs got him, the weight got him, the car got him.
In fairness to him, if I was an artist...
If I was a carpenter...
and I'd written one of his songs...
Telegram Sam.
For me, Children of the Revolution. But you see, we can just... There's loads
there's
of them.
Tons.
I mean, let's just go right now. Ride a White Swan, Hot Love...
Yeah.
Jeepster.
Telegram Sam.
Telegram Sam.
Metal Guru.
Get It On.
Yep. 20th Century Boy.
Solid Gold Easy Action.
Yep. And many others.
Well, that's eight. Children of the Revolution. Did we mention that? Phil Collins ripped off those drums for In the Air Tonight, you know.
Did he?
I'm saying he did. No, they were good. Because they went... Boop, 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 boop. They were really synthetic sounding, but fantastic.
Gated, maybe.
Yeah, whatever that is.
Well, it's when you... It's actually
interesting. No, don't tell me.
When you get rid of the reverb, so it goes... And then stops. It's a very 80s sound. Whereas opposed to letting the drum ring out and go... You get rid of all the tail of it.
Can you see the tumbleweed going through the studio?
So he was born Mark Feld
in
1947.
Nice Jewish boy.
Nice Jewish lad. He was in a band I've just found out at school with Helen Shapiro. Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
The shrieking
Walking
female singer.
Back to happiness.
Right, her.
Oompa,
except you've got to say it in a really full-throated way. You know, she was the death metal singer of her generation. She
Helen Shapiro.
Hell of a pair of lungs on her. No, she was a belter, wasn't she? She probably gave it loads. In her later career, not at this point.
I think Mark was very. If you think of Mark, the oompa, oh yeah, yeah. I mean, there's a whole T Rex oof right there, isn't it?
Yes, there is.
Oompa, oh yeah,
T Rex?
A T Rex?
He was in a band with Helen Shapiro at school. Am I right in saying that one of his first bands was John's Children, right? Which was a sort of. Oh, wait, hang on. He was considered for inclusion in the Yardbirds, I've read somewhere. I didn't know that either until I read it in preparation.
Well, listen, I'm sure Wikipedia is never wrong.
But instead, they whacked him into John's Children because it was Simon Napier-Bell, the manager who looked after all that lot. Yeah.
Manager.
Yes, that's correct.
Yes.
Nick's just made a certain gesture. So, he was the Svengali who.
Personal pop impresario.
That's right, yeah.
They called them in the 60s.
And I can't quite imagine Bolan in the Yardbirds, but there you have it. Maybe he would have been Robert Plant in Led Zeppelin. Who knows, later on. Is that a step too far?
I very fucking
the top,
much.
Top hat and glitter on his face. That's it, yeah, yeah. There's an amusing impression of Bolan by none other than David Bowie, recorded in the studio in the 80s.
Larry the Lamb.
You know Absolute Beginners, the Bowie song?
Yeah.
There's a version that you can hear it on YouTube. When he was recording the vocals for that song in the studio, he was pissing around and doing various amusing impressions of people.
He did Iggy.
He did.
He did Bolan.
And he does want a Bolan. It's not actually that affectionate. It's quite brutal. You know, he does rip into him. But there one has it. Okay, cool. Am I right in saying that he pretty much did, for the years of the 70s, he just did Vegas, right? That was pretty much what he did. Or did he do other stuff?
No, he did do tours. He did Madison Square and things like that. But they became less and less... As he became less and less able. Mm. He used to call it his TCB tours.
Take care of business. Thank you very much, man.
There you go. Yeah. They would leave for like 6 weeks at a time, come back, stockpile loads of drugs, go back out for 6 weeks. But on the road in Vegas or at home at the mansion, same guys, the Memphis Mafia, they called
them. Yeah, right. Red West, Sunny West.
All these guys that he'd grown up with that were just like a circle of yes men.
Until they broke away and they wrote that story, didn't they? Called Elvis. What happened?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, in the end, everybody was made money out of Elvis. Mm. Everybody.
I wonder if Elvis's most important role, looking back, is as a precedent of where not to fuck up and how not to, you know, get some demon to look after your career and give him that much leeway.
Well, it can be seen that way, but it doesn't seem to work, does it? Or we wouldn't have a podcast, you know. Jim Morrison's two huge influences were Elvis Presley and Frank Sinatra. Mm. Robert Plant, Elvis Presley. John Lennon, Elvis Presley.
No one fell from as great a height as Elvis.
No, that's true. But then no one has ever flown as high as he did. It's just extraordinary to think what might have been if the Colonel hadn't come along and just completely ruined the whole thing, poisoned the well.
Was he writing his own songs, Elvis?
No.
So creative capital is not an issue here because he didn't have any. He was a great singer. That was what he did. He sang
well, he was
songs.
A great singer.
An interpreter of other people's tunes.
And what they used to do was, if you had a song for Elvis, the idea was, okay, well, you have to say it's by you and Elvis. And Elvis will get 50% of that.
That happens to this day.
Of course it does. Mm. But, I mean, you know, David Bowie famously wrote...
David Bowie.
Golden years.
Golden years.
Golden years.
Did he know?
Written for Elvis.
I have a funny story about
it. And Elvis David. Rejected it.
I've told you this story before, but I'm just going to say
no,
it
No, please
right?
do, yes. Does this have anything to do with Glenn?
No, it's not. It's the other guy I did, but with Woody Whimsey. I wrote Woody's book a couple of years ago. He
can
told
we
me
just remind people who
story.
Woody is?
Oh, yeah, we can do that. Woody Whimsey is the last man standing of the Spiders from Mars, right. which was Bowie's backup band on various albums, including Ziggy Stardust.
As opposed to Woody from the Bay City Rollers.
Mm.
Yeah. yeah. Just yeah. to get that clear.
No, you're quite right.
Clear.
No, that's important.
Or Woody in the Faces.
Indeed. And
or Woody Guthrie.
In the middle of the recording of one of the albums, I've forgotten which one it was. It was either Ziggy Stardust or possibly Loud Insane. Bowie fucked off to New York to see Elvis play. So this would have been 71 or 72. I can't remember
72.
Which one it was. Right, yeah, yeah. And the great thing about this is that by then, Elvis was playing to a load of suits. So the audience was not full of dramatic-looking people.
Right,
so
right.
what did Bowie wear to go and see
a
Elvis?
Dress.
No, the full Ziggy.
All right.
The full red mullet, the full gear, probably 10-inch platforms, massive shoulders covered in sparkle dust.
Huge and he, balls
And this is
out.
The sweet bit. He arrived late to the show, but his seat was at the front. So Elvis was already on stage giving it, wow, thank you. And Ziggy had to walk all the way past all these fuckers and sit down and take his seat pretty much where the spotlights were. And he was incredibly embarrassed. He wasn't loving it and going, hey, I'm David. No. He was incredibly embarrassed. I love that story.
Bit you always neglect to mention, though, is where Elvis says to him from the stage, hurry up, take a seat, ma'am.
Take a seat, ma'am. You look just like a diamond dog or
no,
something.
No, ma'am.
A oh, ma'am. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Take a seat,
miss. Nice. We used to call a haircut a mullet or something. So, where were we up to?
You're not, still not getting it. I'm saying Elvis thought he was a girl.
No, I did grasp that. I just
he didn't say mullet.
No, I know. I added that bit. Had a, no, I got it. I did get it. No,
a girl.
It was a
he thought
great,
it was a girl.
It was a great joke.
You didn't kind of allow it to breathe, though,
blossom,
did you? No, you shat on it. You shat on my flower.
So poor old Elvis. He spends the 70s getting iller and iller, sicker and sicker, fatter and fatter. And the one thing you cannot
higher
do...
Higher and higher.
The one thing you cannot do in rock music is get fat. You just can't.
This has been another 7Digital production.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.